Part 2. A Global Perspective. The struggle against the guerrilla is not, as one might suppose, a war of lieutenants and captains. The number of troops that must be put in action, the vast areas over which they will be led to do battle, the necessity of coordinating diverse actions over these vast areas, the politico-military measures to be taken regarding the populace, the necessarily close cooperation with various branches of the civil administration, all this requires that operations against the guerrilla be conducted according to a plan, established at a very high command level, capable at any moment of making quick, direct intercession effectively felt in the wide areas affected by modern warfare. Roger Trinquier, 1964. 6. Countering Global Insurgency. Since the United States declared a global war on terrorism following the 9/11 terrorist attacks, some analysts have argued that terrorism is merely a tactic, thus a war on terrorism makes little sense. Francis Fukuyama's comment that the war on terror is a misnomer, terrorism is only a means to an end. In this regard, a war on terrorism makes no more sense than a war on submarines is typical. This view is irrelevant in a policy sense. The term war on terrorism is a political, not an analytical expression, but nonetheless accurate. Indeed, to paraphrase Clausewitz, to wage this war effectively, we must understand its true nature, neither mistaking it for nor trying to turn it into something it is not. We must distinguish Al-Qaeda and the broader militant movements it symbolizes, entities that use terrorism, from the tactic of terrorism itself. In practice, as I will demonstrate, the war on terrorism is a defensive war against a worldwide Islamist jihad, a diverse confederation of movements that uses terrorism as its principal but not its sole tactic. This chapter argues that the present conflict is actually a campaign to counter a globalized Islamist insurgency. Therefore, counterinsurgency theory is more relevant to this war than is traditional counterterrorism. As this analysis shows, a counterinsurgency approach would generate a subtly but substantially different range of actions in prosecuting the war on terrorism. On this basis, the analysis argues for a strategy of disaggregation that seeks to dismantle or de-link the global jihad. Just as the so-called containment strategy was central to the Cold War, likewise a disaggregation strategy would provide a unifying strategic conception for the current war, something that has been lacking to date. Author's Note, 2009. Since I first wrote this monograph in 2003, my thinking on terminology has shifted significantly. In particular, I have ceased using the terms jihad or jihadist to describe the enemy. I explained why in my note on terminology in my preface to The Accidental Guerrilla, New York, Oxford University Press, 2009, where I also explained that throughout that book I used the term takfiri to describe the enemy's ideology and the phrase takfiri terrorist to refer to those who use terrorism to further that ideology. As I explained in that note, the doctrine of takfir disobeys the Quranic injunction against compulsion in religion, Surah Al-Baqarah, 256, and instead holds that Muslims whose beliefs differ from the takfiris are infidels who must be killed. Takfirism is a heresy within Islam. It was outlawed in the 2005 Amman Message, an initiative of King Abdullah II of Jordan, which brought together more than 500 ulamas, Islamic scholars, and Muslim political leaders from the Organization of the Islamic Conference and the Arab League in an unprecedented consensus agreement. A unanimous agreement by all Muslims everywhere as represented by their acknowledged most senior religious authorities and political leaders. Al-Qaeda is takfiri, and its members are universally so described by other Muslims whom they routinely terrorize. In my view, and compellingly for me, in the daily vocabulary of most ordinary local people, religious leaders, and tribal leaders with whom I have worked in the field, Takfirism is the best descriptor for the ideology currently threatening the Islamic world. I prefer it to the terms jihad, jihadist, jihadi, or mujahideen, literally holy war or holy warrior, which cede to the enemy the sacred status they crave, and to irhabi, terrorist, or hirabba, terrorism, which address al-Qaeda's violence but not its ideology. It is also preferable to the terms Salafi or Salafist, which refer to a belief that true Muslims should live like the first four generations of Muslims, the pious ancestors, as-Salaf as-Salih. Most extremists are Salafi, but few Salafi believers are Takfiri, and even fewer are terrorists. Most, while fundamentalist conservatives, have no direct association with terrorism. Thesis. My principal thesis is this. The war on terrorism is actually a campaign to counter a global Islamist insurgency. So counterinsurgency, not counterterrorism, may provide the best approach to the conflict. However, classical counterinsurgency is designed to defeat insurgency in one country. Hence, traditional counterinsurgency theory has limitations in this context. Therefore, we need a new paradigm capable of addressing globalized insurgency. Classical counterinsurgency uses systems analysis, but traditional reductionist systems analysis cannot handle the complexity of insurgency. However, the emerging science of complexity provides new tools for systems assessment. Hence, complex systems analysis may provide new mental models for globalized counterinsurgency. Complex adaptive systems modeling shows that the global nature of the present Islamist jihad, and hence its dangerous character, derives from the links in the system, energy pathways that allow disparate groups to function in an aggregated fashion across intercontinental distances, rather than the elements themselves. Therefore, countering global insurgency does not demand the destruction of every Islamist insurgent from the Philippines to Chechnya. Rather, it demands a strategy of disaggregation, delinking or dismantling, to prevent the dispersed and disparate elements of the jihad movement from functioning as a global system. Applying this approach to the current war generates a new and different range of policy options and strategic choices. The argument is in four parts. In part one, I demonstrate that a worldwide Islamist jihad movement exists, and in part two, I show that it is best understood as an insurgency. In part three, I use complex adaptive systems theory to develop a systems model of insurgency. On the basis of this systems model, in part four, I then propose disaggregation as an appropriate strategy for countering the global Islamist insurgency. The chapter ends with conclusions and recommendations. Part 1. Anatomy of the Global Jihad. We are not fighting so that you will offer us something. We are fighting to eliminate you. Hussein Massawi, Hezbollah, 2003. A Global Movement. Osama bin Laden, leader of the World Islamic Front, commonly known as Al-Qaeda, the base, or Qa'idat al-Jihad, the base of jihad, declared war on the West on February 23, 1998. The declaration was made in a statement entitled World Islamic Front Declaration of War Against Jews and Crusaders. Bin Laden's deputy, Ayman al-Zawahiri, former leader of the organization Egyptian Islamic Jihad, subsequently published a strategy chapter describing a two-phase strategy for global jihad against the West. Neither statement was treated particularly seriously at the time, but in retrospect, each provides an insight into a developing global pattern of Islamist militancy. Bin Laden's declaration of war announced a global campaign against the United States and the West. It issued a fatwa to all Muslims, calling for jihad, thereby indicating that bin Laden claimed religious authority, needed to issue a fatwa, and political authority as a Muslim ruler needed to declare a jihad. Subsequent al-Qaeda statements refer to bin Laden as the Sheikh or Emir, prince or commander of the World Islamic Front, indicating a claim to political and military authority over Islamist militant fighters throughout the world. Thus, al-Qaeda's statement declares a worldwide state of war against the West and simultaneously claims political and military authority over the forces engaged in that war. Unlike a traditional declaration of war, the declaration also claims authority over a worldwide Islamist movement for jihad. Zawahiri's statement, issued shortly after 9/11, announced a specific strategic program for this war. Zawahiri, identified as the principal al-Qaeda operational planner, articulated a two-phase strategy. In the first phase, the global jihad would focus on the greater Middle East area. This spirit of jihad would turn things upside down in the region and force the U.S. out of it. This would be followed by the earth-shattering event which the West trembles at, the establishment of an Islamic caliphate in Egypt. Thus, the first stage of the campaign would re-establish the caliphate, the historical source of spiritual and temporal authority for all Muslims, which existed from the death of Muhammad in A.D. 632 until A.D. 1924, when it was dissolved by the Turkish Republic after the fall of the Ottoman Empire. The second stage of the strategic plan would use the restored caliphate as a launchpad for jihad against the West, in order to remake the world order with the Muslim world in a dominant position. If God wills it, such a state could lead the Islamic world in a jihad against the West. It could also rally the world Muslims around it. Then history would make a new turn, God willing, in the opposite direction against the empire of the United States and the world's Jewish government. A related document, General Guide to the Struggle of Jama'a Islamiyya, Pedoman Umum Perjuangan al-Jama'a al-Islamiyya, issued by al-Qaeda's Southeast Asian ally, Jama'a Islamiyya, J.I., in 2001, articulates a similar interpretation of the caliphate concept. This document states J.I.'s objectives as the establishment of an Islamic state in Indonesia, followed by the creation of a pan-Islamic state in Southeast Asia, Daulah Islamiyah Nusantara, covering Malaysia, Indonesia, the Philippines, Thailand, and Singapore. Once this Islamist superstate is created, J.I.'s aim is to further the establishment of a global pan-Islamic caliphate. Many aspects of al-Qaeda's program could be disputed. The legitimacy of its claimed authority over Muslims and Islamist fighters, the veracity of its claim to have initiated the jihad, the viability of its two-phase strategy, the true extent of its intended pan-Islamic caliphate, or the sincerity of its stated aims could be questioned, for example. Nevertheless, according to open-source information, al-Qaeda has a presence, in the form of sympathizers, sleeper cells, terrorist cadres, or active fighters, in at least 40 countries. Earlier U.S. statements claimed an al-Qaeda presence in 60 countries, and recent assessments have concluded that al-Qaeda is still functioning globally, though disrupted by the destruction of its base in Afghanistan. Indeed, a recent article in the al-Qaeda military journal Al-Battar argued that the destruction of the Afghan sanctuary has enabled a global expansion for al-Qaeda. In the beginning of their war against Islam, the Crusaders had announced that one of their main goals was to destroy the al-Qaeda organization in Afghanistan, and now, look what happened. Thanks to God, instead of being limited to Afghanistan, al-Qaeda broke out into the entire Islamic world and was able to establish an international expansion in several countries, sending its brigades into every Islamic country, destroying the blasphemers' fortresses and purifying the Muslims' countries. Islamist Theaters of Operation. This worldwide pattern of militant Islamist movements appears to function through regional theaters of operation rather than as a monolithic bloc. Theaters are regions where operatives from one country cooperate with operatives from neighboring countries or conduct activities in neighboring countries. Evidence suggests that Islamist groups within theaters follow general ideological or strategic approaches that conform to the pronouncements of Al-Qaeda and share a common tactical style and operational lexicon. But there is no clear evidence that Al-Qaeda directly controls operations in each theater. Indeed, as will be seen, the global jihad appears to be not a single monolithic organization, but a much more complex phenomenon. The principal Islamist theaters so far identified are as follows. The Americas. North America is most prominent as the scene of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, but significant other Al-Qaeda activity has occurred elsewhere in the Americas, including attempts to infiltrate the United States from Mexico and Canada. Latin America has also been identified as a major center for Islamist training, infiltration, supply, and political subversion. In particular, Al-Qaeda has a strong presence in the tri-border area of Argentina, Paraguay, and Brazil, where there is a large Arabic Muslim population. There are regional Al-Qaeda affiliates, like the Mohammed Atta brigades in El Salvador. There is evidence of cooperation between Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah, and there is evidence that the Panama Canal and Western hotel chains have been reconnoitered by Al-Qaeda affiliates in preparation for a possible attack. Western Europe. This theater, except the Iberian Peninsula, which seems to be linked more closely to the North African theater, appears to function primarily as a theater for political organization, subversion, and fundraising. The 9/11 hijackers passed through Western Europe before the attack and are thought to have trained and prepared there. The United Kingdom has long been a significant area of Al-Qaeda activity, including political subversion, recruitment, organization, and web-based propaganda activity. Few terrorist or insurgent attacks directly linked to Al-Qaeda have occurred in Western Europe, although terrorist cells and militant underground groups exist. There is also a growing pattern of sectarian violence by radical Islamists against liberals within Western European society, most notably in the Netherlands and Belgium. Author's Note, 2009. Tragically, of course, since this monograph was written, we have seen numerous actual or attempted terrorist attacks in Western Europe, including the London subway attacks of July 7, 2005, the failed London attack of July 22, 2005, and the August 2006 airline plot, along with plots in France, Belgium, and the Netherlands. Western Europe appears to be very much alive and well as a terrorist operational theater as of 2009. Australasia. Although Australians and New Zealanders suffered heavily in the October 2002 Bali bombing, Australasia has seen no direct terrorist attacks. However, at least one Al-Qaeda-linked JI cell has been uncovered in Australia. Several arrests of alleged radical and terrorist cells within Australia's immigrant populations have occurred. Australians fought with the Taliban, and in the 1980s with Afghan Mujahideen against the Soviets, and JI has used Australia for training, fundraising, and political subversion. There is also evidence that JI has used remote locations in Australia to test chemical and possibly biological warfare agents. In 2000, New Zealand police arrested several refugees of Middle Eastern origin after discovering evidence that they were conducting reconnaissance of the Lucas Heights nuclear reactor in Sydney with the intent to create a nuclear incident during the 2000 Olympic Games. Iberian Peninsula and Maghreb. The Iberian Peninsula and the Maghreb, Muslim Northwest Africa, appear to function as a single theater, with North Africans implicated in the May 2004 Madrid bombing, a subsequent Islamist attempted bombing and gun battle with police, and an assassination attempt on judges of the Spanish Supreme Court. Besides the Madrid attacks, this theater has been fairly active, with major terrorist bombings in Casablanca, Morocco, ongoing Islamist insurgencies in Algeria, Mauritania, Mali, Niger, and Morocco, and terrorist attacks in Tunisia. Al-Qaeda has a subordinate regional franchise in this theater, and the theater is used for training and political subversion, as well as active terrorism and insurgency. There is also ongoing sectarian violence between Muslims and Christians in Nigeria. Greater Middle East. This theater, including Turkey, the Levant, Israel and Palestine, Egypt, the Arabian Peninsula, and Iran, is by far the most active. Ongoing Islamist insurgencies exist in Iraq, Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Turkey, Lebanon, and Israel, and Palestine. Terrorist activity, including bombings, suicide attacks, kidnappings, beheadings, and raids on expatriate housing, is frequent throughout this theater. Al-Qaeda has designated regional affiliates in Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Kurdistan, and probably also has a presence in Iran, Yemen, Jordan, and Israel and Palestine. The 9/11 hijackers passed through Iran and may have received assistance from elements within that country. However, importantly, much of the insurgent and terrorist action in this theater is not sponsored, directed, or controlled by Al-Qaeda. Moreover, there is an entire separate, though interlinked, pattern of Shia terrorism and insurgency across this region, and some Shia groups, especially Lebanese Hezbollah and Hamas, have global ambition and reach. Indeed, there is increasing evidence that, in spite of their religious differences, Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda could be sharing operational information and cooperating in fundraising and recruitment efforts. East Africa. Kenya and Tanzania suffered simultaneous terrorist bombings on U.S. embassies in August 1998. These attacks were coordinated by Al-Qaeda from a base in Sudan, which, in addition to an Al-Qaeda presence, has an ongoing Islamist insurgency against Christian and animist Sudanese. Kenya suffered a subsequent attack on the Kikambala Palace Hotel in Mombasa in 2002 and probably has an ongoing Al-Qaeda presence. Al-Qaeda has also claimed a presence in Somalia, Eritrea, and Ethiopia. Muslim, although not Islamist militias in Somalia and its separatist province of Puntland, provide a failed state environment favorable to the development of Islamist terrorist and extremist cells. The East African and Middle Eastern theaters overlap substantially, with strong connections between Yemen, Sudan, and the Horn of Africa. Nevertheless, there is a distinct regional dynamic in East Africa that is separate to the Middle Eastern dynamic, and this area is a jihad theater in its own right. Author's Note, 2009. Since 2004, the situation in the Horn of Africa has developed significantly with the emergence in Somalia of the Union of Islamic Courts, UIC, which gained control of Mogadishu in 2005 and expelled the internationally recognized transitional federal government to Baidoa. In July 2006, the U.S.-backed Ethiopian invasion of Somalia overthrew the UIC, but since that time, Ash-Shabaab, the youth, Harakat al-Shabaab al-Mujahideen, has emerged from a group of members of the UIC who went underground and formed an insurgency after the UIC was toppled. Somali piracy has also become a focus of international attention, with the deployment of an international naval task force in the wake of numerous attacks by pirates on international shipping in the Gulf of Aden. In Kenya, Tanzania, and some other parts of the East African coast, Al-Qaeda operational cells or other extremist presence has also been noted. The Caucasus and European Russia. The separatist insurgency affecting Chechnya, Georgia, Azerbaijan, and other parts of the North Caucasus was initially nationalist rather than Islamist in character, but has been infiltrated and co-opted by elements allied to Al-Qaeda. After the 1994-1996 Chechen War, Chechnya briefly enjoyed autonomous self-government, but it became a haven for Islamist movements and a launching pad for terrorist attacks within European Russia. This led to the Second Chechen War, commencing in 1999 and still ongoing, which has seen further Islamist infiltration of Chechnya, Georgia, and Azerbaijan. Incidentally, the use of Chechnya as a terrorist haven during its period of self-rule compromised, perhaps fatally, the Chechen separatist cause, which is now seen largely as a cover for Islamist terrorist activity. Numerous terrorist attacks have occurred across European Russia, carried out by groups linked to the Chechen insurgency. These have included a spate of suicide bombings, aircraft bombings, and hijackings. The 2002 Dubrovka theater siege and the atrocious 2004 massacre of hundreds of schoolchildren in Beslan, North Ossetia. Author's Note, 2009. As of 2009, the Chechen war is in remission in Chechnya itself, though Chechens and Dagestanis continue to fight, both in the Caucasus and in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Russian operations have severely disabled the insurgency, and Russia officially ended its counterinsurgency operation on April 16, 2009. Violence is still sporadic, but at a much lower level than at the original time of writing. The appointment as president of the Chechen Republic of Russian-backed local strongman Ramzan Kadyrov, son of the assassinated former president Ahmad Kadyrov and a former insurgent and militia leader, has contributed to the suppression of violence, but has also prompted claims of severe human rights abuses and political repression. South and Central Asia. Bin Laden's declaration of war of February 23, 1998, was co-signed by leaders from Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, and South Asia has long been a key jihad theater. Afghanistan was the principal al-Qaeda sanctuary until October 2001. A symbiosis developed between the Taliban government and numerous Islamist groups that shared facilities and allied themselves with al-Qaeda. Prominent among these was Lashkar-e-Taiba, which, since the fall of the Taliban, has become al-Qaeda's principal South Asian ally. The provincially administered tribal areas, Pata, and federally administered tribal areas, Fata, on the Afghan-Pakistan border, have become a haven for al-Qaeda, who are cooperating with Taliban remnants fighting as guerrillas in the area. Bin Laden and Zawahiri are believed to be in Pakistan's northwest frontier province, hiding in an area administered by a federation of six Islamist parties that rejects Pakistani sovereignty, supports the Taliban remnants, and indirectly protects al-Qaeda. Pakistan itself has experienced Islamist subversion, agitation, and terrorist activity, as has neighboring India. The ongoing separatist insurgency in Jammu and Kashmir has been infiltrated by Islamist elements, and Kashmir has become a major training and administrative area for al-Qaeda affiliates. The neighboring republics of former Soviet Central Asia, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, and Tajikistan, and the Xinjiang Uyghur region of China, have also seen Islamist subversion, terrorist activity, and low-level insurgency. Author's Note, 2009. This description of the situation in South Asia is, of course, markedly out of date. I have described the situation as of 2008 in detail in The Accidental Guerrilla, Chapter 2. However, the situation is rapidly developing and continues to change unpredictably in the wake of the August 2009 Afghanistan presidential election and the troop surge announced by President Obama and key NATO allies in December 2009. Southeast Asia. There are Islamist insurgencies in Indonesia, the Philippines, and southern Thailand, with substantial terrorist activity in these countries and in Singapore, Malaysia, and Cambodia. There is also a broader pattern of Islamic militancy, Muslim separatist insurgent movements, and sectarian conflict. This includes major separatist movements such as the Free Aceh movement. Indonesia has a substantial underground Islamist movement, Darul Islam, which dates back to World War II and is still active in several regions of Indonesia. The principal terrorist grouping in this regional theater is JI, which operates across the entire region, maintains links to al-Qaeda and other global groups, cooperates with and co-opts local movements and grievances, and has links into other theaters, including South Asia and the Middle East. As discussed above, JI has articulated a pan-Islamic agenda that aligns closely with that of Al-Qaeda. However, the two groups are better understood as allies, rather than seeing JI as an Al-Qaeda subordinate or franchise. The Abu Sayyaf group is a Philippines-based ally of JI, and there are two other major Islamic separatist groups operating in the Mindanao region of the Philippines. Several other armed Islamic sectarian groups have engaged in armed conflict, insurgency, and subversion in this region. Author's Note, 2009. The insurgency situation in Southeast Asia has also developed significantly, with JI in Indonesia collapsing in terms of popular support and operational capability, although it retains the ability to strike at Western targets within Indonesia. The Abu Sayyaf group in the Philippines has also been degraded through successful cooperation between local law enforcement, local military forces, national governments, and U.S. military, law enforcement, and intelligence agencies. The insurgency in southern Thailand has worsened, in part because of political instability at the national level, and was described in detail in The Accidental Guerrilla, Chapter 4. The first three theaters, the Americas, Western Europe, and Australasia, do not have ongoing active insurgencies. Indeed, Australasia and Western Europe appear to be predominantly theaters of subversion, fundraising, and organizational development, representing Al-Qaeda's strategic hinterland, whereas North America appears to be a primary target for terrorist activity. The remaining six theaters, however, all have active Islamist insurgencies, as well as Al-Qaeda presence and terrorist activity. Indeed, globally, there is a greater than 85% correlation between the presence of Islamist insurgency in a given theater and terrorist activity or Al-Qaeda presence in the same area. Thus, with the exception of the 9/11 attacks themselves, all Al-Qaeda-linked terrorist attacks have occurred in theaters with ongoing Islamist insurgencies. Not all Islamist insurgency is linked to Al-Qaeda, but most Al-Qaeda activity occurs in areas of Islamist insurgency. Besides this correlation with insurgency, there is a clear correlation between the geographical area of the historical caliphate, the broader pan-Islamic caliphate posited by Al-Qaeda, and Islamist insurgency. As the map indicates, every single Islamist insurgency in the world sits within the claimed pan-Islamic caliphate, while the most active theaters correspond to the historical caliphate. Taken at face value, this map seems to show that Al-Qaeda is indeed executing the strategy outlined by Zawahiri, re-establishing an Islamic caliphate, and then using this as a springboard to extend Islamic control over the remainder of the globe. In fact, the reality turns out to be much more complex. Nonetheless, the map accurately portrays the existence of a global spread of Islamist movements, at least some of which are linked to a broader, globally focused movement that seeks to overturn the world order through subversion, terrorism, and insurgency. Links between theaters. The mere existence of a global spread of similar movements does not in itself constitute evidence for a global insurgency. To demonstrate the existence of a global jihad, it is necessary to show that these dispersed Islamist terrorist and insurgent groups are linked in some way. Indeed, the links are critical, because, as discussed in the next section, the global nature of the jihad actually resides in the links, not the individual groups themselves. There are eight basic types of links that join these theaters, and groups within them, into an aggregated pattern of global jihad. Ideological links. Insurgent and terrorist groups aligned with Al-Qaeda have common ideological roots. They are broadly Salafi in orientation, and many follow variants of Saudi Wahhabism. Even groups such as the Taliban, which is Deobandi in origin, adopt a purist, authoritarian outlook. ideologues such as Sayyid Qutb, Maulana Maududi, Abdullah Azam, and the medieval theologian Ibn Taymiyyah are influential in their thinking. These jihadists are so called because they tend to elevate the lesser jihad, armed struggle against unbelievers, into a virtual sixth pillar of Islam. Besides Islamic influences, these groups are influenced by communist revolutionary technique, adopting Soviet organizational methods and consciously acting as a vanguard party in the Leninist mode, and military theory. Many Islamist insurgents, particularly in Afghanistan, apply Che Guevara's concept of Focoist insurgency, while Carlos Marighella's mini-manual of the urban guerrilla has also been very influential. Al-Qaeda applies leaderless resistance, first advanced by the American right-wing theorist Louis Beam, to an unprecedented degree. Finally, concepts such as propaganda of the deed, which originated with the 19th-century European anarchists, are influential. The most important element of ideological commonality is that the Islamist groups described identify themselves with Al-Qaeda, subscribe to its strategic program, and seek a global pan-Islamic caliphate as a prelude to remaking the Western-dominated world order. Linguistic and cultural links. Because of their shared Islamic faith, jihad groups share Arabic as a common language. This allows groups from remote parts of the world to communicate effectively, train together, and share intelligence or planning resources. It also contributes to a shared consciousness, religious, political, and cultural. These groups also share an Islamic civilizational overlay, providing a common language, social outlook, and political theory for groups from diverse national cultures. Moreover, as these groups originate from what Michael Vlahos has called distinct military subcultures within Islam, they share a common sense of alienation from mainstream Islam's traditions of quietism or political moderation. Personal history. The personal histories of individuals across the jihad movements are closely linked. Many older mujahideen fought together against the Soviets in Afghanistan during the 1980s or trained together later in Afghanistan. Many key ideologues and leaders in the global jihad studied under Wahhabi clerics in Saudi Arabia and still maintain relationships with these mentors. For example, JI leader Abu Bakr Bashir maintains a close relationship with his former teacher and seeks guidance before most major decisions. The senior leadership of Al-Qaeda all share this experience, and many have links dating back to the 1970s and opposition to the Egyptian and Saudi governments. Later generations of mujahideen fought together in Kosovo, Bosnia-Herzegovina, or Chechnya. Even within one country, many jihadists share a common military or personal history. For example, many JI members come from established families in the Indonesian Darul Islam movement, described above, went to school together, fought together in sectarian conflicts in Maluku or Sulawesi, and trained together in boarding schools or camps like Camp Abu Bakr in the Philippines. Thus, friendships, webs of acquaintance, and networks of mutual obligation stretch worldwide between and among groups. Similarly, within jihad theaters, groups cooperate and develop bonds of shared experience and mutual obligation. Family relationships. Unsurprisingly, because of this shared history, many members of the global jihad movement are related to each other by birth or marriage. Often alliances between groups are cemented by marriage, as in the marriage of Osama bin Laden to the daughter of Taliban leader Mullah Omar. Similarly, some Indonesian jihadist leaders have wives from the Arabian Peninsula, particularly the Hadramaut area on the Saudi-Yemen-Oman border. Again, intermarriage is common among Southeast Asian, South Asian, and Chechen jihad groups, cementing bonds of friendship and obligation between theaters. Sons of prominent leaders in the jihad movement often follow their fathers, and widows often avenge their husbands by becoming suicide bombers. This pattern has become so common in Chechnya and European Russia that such mujahidat, female jihad fighters, known as Black Widows, have been implicated in numerous attacks and have gained independent status as a distinct subcategory of jihadist. Financial links. Groups in different theaters frequently fund each other's activities. For example, Al-Qaeda is suspected to have provided funding to JI for the 2002 Bali bombing and is known to have funded terrorist groups in the Philippines. Similarly, some Islamic non-government organizations, including traditional Islamic Hawala banking networks, charitable organizations, and religious networks, are used, wittingly and unwittingly, as conduits for funding between and within jihad theaters globally. Many of these non-government organizations are based in the Arabian Peninsula, including significant and legitimate charities such as Al-Haramain and the Islamic Relief Organization. Indeed, oil wealth in the Middle East has provided the bulk of terrorist and insurgent funding over time, making the Arabian Peninsula a central hub in the web of financial links joining dispersed movements. The systems of traditional trade, as well as flows of remittance money from migrant workers worldwide, also represent conduits for insurgent and terrorist funding. In addition, there is an intricate network of private patronage, financial obligation, and mutual commitment that links dispersed groups and individuals in geographically dispersed regions. Operational and planning links. As this analysis shows, Al-Qaeda is not a central headquarters or high command for the global jihad. Bin Laden does not issue directives to subordinate groups, tasking them to conduct insurgent or terrorist action. Rather, planning and operational tasking appears to happen through a system of sponsorship and financing, with Al-Qaeda providing funding, operational advice, targeting data, and specialist expertise to allied regional and local groups. Similarly, local groups appear to gather intelligence and targeting data and share it across theaters in the jihad. For example, the planned JI attacks foiled in Singapore in December 2001 were averted through the discovery of targeting data in an Al-Qaeda safe house in Afghanistan. A recent terrorist alert in the United States was sparked by the discovery of targeting data on American schools and public buildings on a captured terrorist's computer in Pakistan. The same arrest also prompted the capture of 8 terrorists in Britain. So although there is no centralized command and control hierarchy, it appears that local groups plan and conduct their own operations, but cooperate within and between regions. Simultaneously, global players like Al-Qaeda provide encouragement, tactical support, financing, and intelligence for specific high-value operations. Propaganda. Al-Qaeda exploits events in jihad theaters across the world for propaganda purposes in its communiques and media materials. Groups across the jihad contribute to a common flow of propaganda materials, supporting each other's local causes and sharing grievances. For example, the website Jihad Unspun is managed by a Canadian convert to Islam and provides reportage, analysis, comment, and spin on issues across all theaters of the jihad. Al-Qaeda issues a fortnightly propaganda bulletin on its official website, Saut al-Jihad, and publishes a jihadist women's magazine, Al-Khansa. Similarly, a flow of cassette tapes, videos, and CDs, many depicting so-called martyrdom operations, as well as terrorist bombings or the execution of infidel prisoners, moves throughout jihad groups worldwide. For example, the Russian Hell series of videos, many depicting the torture and execution of Russian troops captured in Chechnya, is popular viewing across South Asia, the Middle East, and Indonesia, and is current among certain militant extremist subcultures within the Australian Muslim community. Imagery purporting to portray the oppression of Muslims in Israel and Palestine, Chechnya, Iraq, and the Balkans is also used to stir up resentment and motivate mujahideen in other theaters. The Zarqawi network inside Iraq, subsequently known as Al-Qaeda in Iraq, is also believed to maintain a media section that is responsible for the production of propaganda materials, including videos of the beheading of Western hostages. The Internet has become a potent tool that groups use for sharing propaganda and ideological material across international boundaries, contributing to a shared consciousness among dispersed groups within the jihad. Author's Note, 2009. Al-Qaeda and its associated movements have maintained a focus on propaganda since their formation, with the Al-Qaeda senior leadership group often acting more like a propaganda hub than like a command center, identifying themes in Western debate and playing these back at the West. Osama bin Laden has not issued a video communique for several years, and the West's ongoing pressure against Al-Qaeda leaders in the Pakistan-Afghanistan border area has undoubtedly suppressed, to some extent, their activities. But the propaganda model has also shifted over time. A single narrative of oppression, redemption, and resistance against an infidel West bent on the destruction of Islam has taken hold in some parts of the world's Muslim community, fueled in part by the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and by the ongoing violence in Israel and the Palestinian territories. This has empowered local activists who generate their own propaganda in general alignment with broad Al-Qaeda themes, but do not take propaganda guidance from a central Al-Qaeda leadership. In this sense, what was once a jihadist startup enterprise has now become self-sustaining and semi-independent. Doctrine, Techniques, and Procedures. Terrorist and insurgent groups worldwide can access a body of doctrine, techniques, and procedures that exists in hard copy and on the Internet, primarily in Arabic, but also in other languages. It includes political guidance, like the General Guide to the Struggle of Jama'a Islamiyah, described earlier. Military manuals, like the encyclopedic Military Studies in the Jihad Against the Tyrants, discovered by police in Manchester, England in 2002, and CD-ROM and videotaped materials. In addition, Al-Qaeda publishes a fortnightly online military training manual, Al-Battar. There is thus a common tactical approach across Islamist groups worldwide, and tactics that first appear in one theater permeate across the global movement via the Internet and doctrinal publications. Author's Note, 2009. This dispersion of tactics has only increased since this chapter was written, with the proliferation of tactics developed in Iraq, such as suicide bombings and the use of roadside improvised explosive devices, into Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia, and elsewhere. We have also seen the physical movement of fighters between theaters, former members of Al-Qaeda in Iraq into Yemen, Chechens and Uzbeks into Pakistan and Afghanistan, Indonesians and Malaysians into the Philippines, Somalis into Kenya, and so on. These fighters bring with them knowledge of tactics, techniques, and procedures, and contribute to a general tactical style or way of war as practiced by these groups. Local, regional, and global players. Within each country in a jihad theater, there are local actors, issues, and grievances. Many of these have little to do with the objectives of the global jihad, and they often predate the jihad by decades or centuries. For example, Russians have been fighting Muslim guerrillas in the Caucasus since the 1850s, while there has been a Moro separatist issue in the Philippines for centuries. Local insurgent and terrorist groups, in some cases little distinguishable from bandits, continue to operate in these areas, often with no connection to the global jihad. These local elements will probably remain intact at some level, even if the global jihad movement is completely destroyed. But what is new about today's environment is that, because of the links described above, a new class of regional, theater-level actors has emerged. These groups do have links to the global jihad, often act as regional allies or affiliates of Al-Qaeda, and prey on local groups and issues to further the jihad. They also rely on supporting inputs from global players and might wither if their global sponsors were significantly disrupted. For example, in Indonesia, the regional Al-Qaeda affiliate, JI, has fueled, exacerbated, and fostered sectarian conflicts in the Poso region of central Sulawesi in order to generate recruits, anti-Western propaganda, funding, and grievances that can be exploited within the Southeast Asia Theater. In turn, JI has received funding, guidance, expertise, and propaganda support from Al-Qaeda. In general, Al-Qaeda seems not to have direct dealings with local insurgent groups, but to deal primarily with its regional affiliates in each theater. This makes the operational, regional or theater level of the jihad a critical link. Sitting above the theater-level actors are global players like Al-Qaeda. But Al-Qaeda is simply the best known of several worldwide actors. Al-Qaeda has competitors, allies, and clones at the global level who would be able to step into the breach should Al-Qaeda be destroyed tomorrow. For example, the Shia group Hezbollah has global reach, has worked closely with Sunni movements worldwide, sponsors approximately 80% of Palestinian terrorism, including that performed by Sunni groups such as Hamas, and has strong links to Iran. Hezbollah is one of several groups that could replace Al-Qaeda in its niche of top predator as the jihad evolves. Similarly, financial, religious, educational, and cultural networks, based largely in Arabia, function at the global level in unifying the effect of disparate actors across the jihad and often have greater penetration and influence than Al-Qaeda itself. Thus, this analysis indicates that there is a global movement, and almost all Islamist insurgency and terrorism worldwide is linked to it. However, it comprises a group of aligned, independent movements, not a single, unified organization. Global players link and exploit local players through regional affiliates. They rarely interact directly with local players, but sponsor and support them through intermediaries. Each theater has operational players who are able to tap into the global jihad, and these tend to be regional Al-Qaeda affiliates. Saudi Arabia is a central node, with greater reach than Al-Qaeda itself, although Saudi influence is a systemic effect, not necessarily based on conscious activity. As Al-Qaeda is disrupted, its clones and competitors will probably tend to move into its niche and assume some of its role. Author's Note, 2009. Despite the undoubtedly central role of Saudi Arabia in the early thinking of many Takfiri terrorist groups, in practical terms, the epicenter of violent extremism worldwide increasingly resides in Pakistan. Many major terrorist attacks since 9/11, especially in Europe, India, and Central Asia, have included links to groups sponsored by or operating in Pakistan. There is debate over whether the center of gravity of the global jihadist endeavor has truly shifted to Pakistan, but there is little doubt that South Asia is one of the most important and dangerous theaters of terrorist activity. Understanding the jihad phenomenon. So far, this chapter has shown that a globalized network of Islamist groups exists, that this network tends to operate through distinct regional theaters, and that there are multidimensional links that connect the operations of dispersed groups across theaters. In other words, the multifarious groups and activities of Islamists, including terrorists, subversives, political activists, and insurgents, in fact form a single global system. But we have also seen that this jihad is not a single unified movement or a hierarchical organization. Al-Qaeda is not the headquarters for a unified worldwide organization. Indeed, many of the links that unite the dispersed movements are personal, private, historical, or ideological, not hierarchical or organizational. In seeking to understand the jihad, Western analysts have often struggled to characterize it. Is it a formal organization? Is it a mass movement? Is it a loose confederation of allies? Is it, as Peter Bergen argues, a franchised business model with centralized corporate support and autonomous regional divisions? Is it, as others have argued, merely a myth, a creation of Western counterintelligence agencies and authoritarian governments? The picture of the jihad this chapter has drawn suggests that far from being a mythical boogeyman, the network is all too real, global in reach, and unprecedented in scale. but Western models, mass movement, hierarchical organization, business structure, are unable to fully describe it. Rather, the analysis would suggest traditional Islamic or Middle Eastern social models may be more applicable. Carl Jackson, during fieldwork in 1968, and I, during fieldwork in 1995 to 1997, both independently demonstrated that a model of traditional patron-client authority relationships is applicable to Islamic insurgent movements. Under this model, the global jihad could be seen as a variant on a traditional Middle Eastern patronage network. In this construct, the jihad comprises an intricate, ramified web of dependency and, critically, it is the patterns of patronage and dependency that are its central defining features rather than the organizational groupings, the insurgent cells, or their activities. Many analysts have tended to see the marriage relationships, money flows, alumni relationships, and sponsorship links in the jihad as weakly subordinate to a military core of terrorist activity. Rather, this analysis would argue the military activity is actually subordinate, being merely one of the shared activities that the network engages in, while the core is the patronage network. As noted, analysts tend to apply Western models to the jihad: mass movement, hierarchical organization, franchised business structure. In fact, the jihad appears to be more like a tribal group, an organized crime syndicate, or an extended family than like a military organization. Author's Note, 2009. There are strong analogies between police work, counterinsurgency, and counterterrorism. Insurgents tend to operate like gang structures, and police gang suppression approaches that focus on community security, network displacement, and a layered method of overt police presence, criminal informants, and undercover operations is analogous to counterinsurgency, especially in urban environments. Likewise, some terrorist networks share structural and operational similarities with organized crime networks, and police methods against organized crime syndicates, financial and logistical controls, counter-network operations, detainee exploitation, penetration by informants, and targeted disruption are similar to the methods used against terrorists. Like a mafia clan, the Islamist network resides in a web of traditional authority structures, family allegiances, and tribal honor, not the essentially secondary activity of criminal behavior. Thus, the Islamist network resides in the pattern of relationships itself. Jihad is simply one activity that the network does. It is not the network itself. Part 2. Global Islamist Insurgency. If you were afraid to carry out the jihad in the Arabian Peninsula, what is your excuse for not going to Iraq, Afghanistan, and Chechnya? Sheikh Saud al-Otaibi, Emir of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, 2004. Part 1 has demonstrated the existence of a globalized Islamist jihad network, forming an intricate web of dependencies and patronage, and oriented, as a loose confederation of allies, toward the overthrow of the existing world order and its replacement with a pan-Islamic caliphate. As this part will show, this Islamist jihad is best understood as a global insurgency. Insurgency can be defined as a popular movement that seeks to overthrow the status quo through subversion, political activity, insurrection, armed conflict, and terrorism. By definition, insurgent movements are grassroots uprisings that seek to overthrow established governments or societal structures. All are popular uprisings that employ the weapons of the weak, subversion, guerrilla tactics, terrorism, against the established power of states and conventional military forces. Many, including the Islamist Jihad, draw their foot soldiers from deprived socioeconomic groups and their leadership from alienated, radicalized elites. Conversely, terrorism can be defined as politically motivated violence against civilians, conducted with the intention to coerce through fear. and is in the tactical repertoire of virtually every insurgency, and of course, some governments. Western analysts tend to distinguish insurgency from terrorism as research disciplines, but for practitioners, this distinction is literally academic. Terrorism is a component in almost all insurgencies and insurgent objectives, that is, a desire to change the status quo through subversion and violence, lie behind almost all non-state terrorism. By this definition, the global jihad is clearly an insurgency, a popular movement that seeks to change the status quo through violence and subversion, whereas terrorism is one of its key tactics, hence a component part or subset of insurgency. But whereas traditional insurgencies sought to overthrow governments or social structures in one state or region, this insurgency seeks to transform the entire Islamic world and remake its relationship with the rest of the globe. It looks back to a golden age, seeking to reestablish a caliphate throughout the Muslim world and ultimately expand the realm of Islam, Dar al-Islam, to all human society. The stated Islamist strategy is to provoke a clash between the West and Islam, generate a world Islamic front, and so mobilize Muslims, whom the Islamists see as oppressed victims, to overthrow the global status quo. The scale of the Islamist agenda is new, but their grievances and methods would be familiar to any insurgent in history. In addition, bin Laden's own fatwa of August 1996 explicitly calls for insurgency in the cause of jihad. It must be obvious to you that due to the imbalance of power between our armed forces and the enemy forces, a suitable means of fighting must be adopted, that is using fast-moving light forces that work under complete secrecy. In other words, to initiate guerrilla warfare, where the sons of the nation and not the military forces take part in it. The jihad, therefore, can be described as a form of globalized insurgency. Al-Qaeda and similar groups feed on local grievances, integrate them into broader ideologies, and link disparate conflicts through globalized communications, finances, and technology. In this, Al-Qaeda resembles the communist Third International, Comintern, of the 20th century, a holding company and clearinghouse for world revolution. But there is a key difference. The Comintern was a state-sponsored support organization for local revolutions and insurgencies, but the global jihad is itself an insurgent movement. As described, the tools of globalization, the internet, globalized communications, international finance, freedom of movement, allow tactics, intelligence, personnel, and finances to be shared between groups across the jihad. Likewise, the globalized insurgency exploits events in one theater for propaganda in others. Moreover, the Comintern was sponsored by the Soviet Union, whereas the Islamist jihad, as discussed later, is itself a virtual state. Thus, the distinguishing feature of the Islamists is not their use of terrorism, a tactic they share with dozens of movements worldwide. Rather, it is that they represent a global insurgency against the world order that, like all other insurgent movements, uses terrorism, besides other tactics ranging from subversion and propaganda to open warfare. Competing paradigms: terrorism and insurgency. The study of terrorism as an independent academic discipline emerged in the 1970s in response to the growing phenomenon of international terrorism. Before the 1970s, terrorism was seen primarily as a component within localized insurgencies. The term was used primarily for propaganda purposes, to label an insurgent as illegitimate or portray an insurgent's methods as beyond the pale. British use of the term terrorists to describe insurgents in Northern Ireland, Cyprus, and Malaya served to underline this point. Indeed, in Malaya, the principal counterinsurgency manual was entitled The Conduct of Anti-Terrorist, Not Counterinsurgency, Operations in Malaya, indicating that the two activities were synonymous. In this period, insurgency and terrorism were seen as practically the same phenomenon. The term terrorism was primarily of political and propaganda value. But the international terrorism that emerged in the 1970s included groups such as the Baader-Meinhof Group, the Red Army faction, the Italian Red Brigades, the Japanese Red Army, and other groups with little apparent link to any mass movement or insurgency. Rather, they were disembodied terrorist groups comprising small cells of alienated individuals within Western society, rather than insurgent movements with definite achievable aims. Although there were still substantial groups of insurgency-based terrorists, such as the PLO, rightly regarded by specialists as one of the most important and dangerous groups, in Western popular culture, the conception of terrorism became that of disembodied cells of radicalized, nihilistic individuals. These individuals, almost by virtue of their very alienation from their parent societies, could not and did not tap into a mass base that drew its legitimacy from popular grievances, as traditional insurgents and today's transnational jihadist terrorists do. Thus, a new paradigm emerged that has since been highly influential in public discourse. In this popular conception, shared by many Western legislators and policymakers, although not by terrorism specialists, terrorists are seen as unrepresentative, aberrant individuals, misfits within society. Partly because they are seen as unrepresentative, and partly to discourage emulation, we do not negotiate with terrorists. Terrorists are criminals whose methods and objectives are equally unacceptable. They use violence partly to shock and influence populations and governments and for propaganda and symbolic effect, but also because they are psychologically or morally flawed or evil. In this paradigm, terrorism is primarily a law enforcement problem, and we therefore adopt a case-based approach in which the key objective is to apprehend the perpetrators of terrorist attacks. Author's Note, 2009. This description of terrorism as a popular paradigm was already something of a caricature when it was first written, but is even more so now, as a new generation of extremely sophisticated terrorism analysts have emerged over the period since 9/11, with fresh and innovative approaches to understanding terrorist behavior. Still, in its original intent, this passage, like the description of insurgency and counterinsurgency below it, is designed to highlight the differences in popular perception between the methods of counterterrorism, counter-network operations, manhunting, and the pursuit of individuals and cells as high-value targets through intelligence, law enforcement, and special operations, and counterinsurgency, population protection, political marginalization of the insurgent, addressing of basic grievances, reduction of insurgent recruiting and propaganda opportunities, denial of resources, and so on. In practice, any counterinsurgency campaign today involves highly kinetic, intelligence-led counter-network operations, while any sensible counter-terrorism campaign also seeks to isolate terrorists from support networks and deny them freedom of movement and action. Thus, counter-terrorism and counter-insurgency techniques merge and blur at the tactical level, even though the two approaches are still seen as competing paradigms by the public, news organizations, and many policymakers. This paradigm has been highly influential in our approach to the war on terrorism, largely because of the word terrorism in this name. Thus, we have tended to elevate one component of the global insurgency, the use of terrorism as a tactic, until it has become identified as the sole issue, ignoring other aspects of the conflict. Accordingly, we have sought to apprehend Osama bin Laden, and some commentators regard the failure to catch him as evidence of failure in prosecuting the war on terror. Likewise, Australia's response to the Bali bombing of 2002 has been primarily focused on bringing the terrorists to justice, hence the central role of police agencies in a case-based, legal evidence-based approach. Author's Note, 2009. This is not to suggest that such approaches are invalid or ineffective. Indeed, in Australia's case, police and intelligence assistance to Indonesia proved very important in reducing the JI threat to a far lower level over the period 2002 to 2007. However, such tactical counter-terrorism efforts do not substitute for a broader global strategic approach to reducing the appeal and minimizing the threat of globalized insurgency. The insurgency paradigm is quite different. Under this approach, insurgents are regarded as representative of deeper issues or grievances within society. Governments seek to defeat insurgents primarily through marginalizing them from their support base, protecting the people from guerrilla intimidation, and winning the hearts and minds of the broader population, a process that by necessity often involves compromise and negotiation. We regard insurgents' methods as unacceptable, but their grievances are often seen as legitimate, provided they are pursued peacefully. This is why mainstream society often accepts insurgents who renounce violence but seek the same objectives through political means. Individuals like Nelson Mandela, Xanana Gusmão, and Gerry Adams. Similarly, under this paradigm, we see insurgents as using violence within a carefully integrated politico-military strategy, rather than as psychopaths. In this paradigm, insurgency is a whole-of-government problem, rather than a military or law enforcement issue. On this basis, we adopt a strategy-based approach to counterinsurgency, in which the key objective is to defeat or marginalize the insurgent's strategy, rather than to apprehend the perpetrators of specific acts. However, as noted, the terrorism paradigm largely represents a popular stereotype rather than an analysis shared by most specialist analysts, some of whom tend to regard terrorism as a subset or subcategory of insurgency. Clearly, the insurgency paradigm provides a better mental model for the current conflict than does the terrorism stereotype. Indeed, current actions in the war on terrorism appear disparate if viewed through a pure terrorism paradigm. Some, like international law enforcement cooperation, manhunting and drone strikes, and actions to counter terrorist financing, fit the terrorism paradigm neatly, while others, the Iraq War, counter-proliferation initiatives, building influence in Central Asia, containment of North Korea and Iran, appear unrelated to an anti-terrorism agenda and are thus viewed with suspicion by some. However, if viewed through the lens of counterinsurgency, these actions make perfect sense. They fit neatly into three streams of classical counterinsurgency: pacification, winning hearts and minds, and the denial of sanctuary and external sponsorship. For example, whatever one thinks of its effectiveness, the intent behind the Iraq campaign may be seen as an effort to restructure the milieu that created the jihad by removing underlying anti-democratic tendencies that cause Islamist unrest, a form of pacification, in intent if not effect. It may also have been intended to address the principal grievances raised by Al-Qaeda in its World Islamic Front Declaration of War Against Jews and Crusaders of February 23, 1998, which mostly related to the sanctions regime against Saddam's Iraq, winning hearts and minds. Action against Iraq also allowed the removal of U.S. troops from Saudi Arabia, another key Al-Qaeda grievance, and sent a key message to state sponsors of terrorism: denial of sanctuary and sponsorship. Moreover, at a strategic level, the campaign in Iraq has allowed Western forces to fight the jihad on ground of our choosing, within the territory of the old caliphate now claimed by Al-Qaeda, rather than on Western territory or in South or Central Asia. This has given the West the strategic initiative. Jihadists are focusing on Iraq, not on attacking the West directly. Author's Note, 2009. The intent of this passage is not to defend the decision to attack Iraq or the poor performance in the early execution of the counterinsurgency campaign following the initial highly successful coalition invasion of Iraq. I am on the record elsewhere, Small Wars Journal and Accidental Guerrilla, arguing that the invasion was a strategic error. Rather, the aim is to show that a counterinsurgency paradigm makes much more strategic sense in explaining the decision to go to war than a traditional counterterrorism approach. Thus, a set of strategic ideas associated with traditional counterinsurgency, sanctuary denial, marginalizing the enemy, denial of sponsorship by external actors, and winning hearts and minds, may have lain, perhaps at the level of unexamined assumption, behind the war. If these concepts had been explicitly examined within a counterinsurgency lens, some decision-makers might have concluded, as I do in the next section of this chapter, that traditional counterinsurgency actually transfers poorly to the global level. In the event, Western military forces and Western political capital have been invested heavily in the outcome of the war. Although we salvaged a draw during the 2007 surge and handed off a relatively stable environment to the Iraqi government in 2008, the Iraq war is far from over for Iraqis, and ultimately, its strategic impact may not be clear for a considerable time. One might argue with the competence or wisdom of the Iraq enterprise, or the clarity with which its objectives were communicated to the public, as many analysts and political opponents of the United States have done. Nevertheless, Iraq undeniably fits better into a counterinsurgency paradigm than a traditional counterterrorist one. The same applies to action against North Korea, denial of sanctuary and sponsorship, in this case, transfer of nuclear and chemical technology to Islamists, and other apparently disparate actions in the campaign. If the war on terrorism is a global insurgency, then the counterinsurgency paradigm, which, as noted, includes action against terrorism as a subset of insurgency, is a better mental model for this war than is counterterrorism. Indeed, the key to defeating global jihad may not lie in traditional counterterrorism, police work, intelligence, special operations, or security measures at all. Instead, counterinsurgency theory may provide the most useful insights. As I will explain in Part 4, a counterinsurgency approach would generate a subtly but substantially different range of actions in the war on terrorism. Counterinsurgency Redux. Although counterinsurgency is more appropriate than counterterrorism in this conflict, traditional counterinsurgency techniques from the 1960s cannot simply be applied to today's problems in a simplistic or mechanistic fashion. This is because counterinsurgency, in its classical form, is optimized to defeat insurgency in one country, not to fight a global insurgency. The best practice counterinsurgency techniques that emerged from the Wars of National Liberation of 1945 to 1990 attacked insurgency through unified military, intelligence, political, socioeconomic, hearts and minds, and security measures. For example, pacification programs in classical counterinsurgency demand the ability to coordinate information operations, development, governance, military and police security operations, and overt and covert counter-guerrilla operations across a geographical area, often a province or region. At the national level, control of all counterinsurgent actions, political, military, social, and economic, in the hands of a single supremo, is recognized as a key element. This can be achieved in one country, Malaya, Northern Ireland, and other campaigns demonstrated this. But to achieve this level of integration requires excellent governmental stability, unity, and restraint. Moreover, it demands extremely close coordination and integration between and within police, intelligence, military, development, aid, information, and administrative agencies. For example, the successful Malayan campaign rested on an overall supremo with combined military, political, and administrative powers, supported by an intricate system of federal, state, district, and sub-district executive interagency committees. Likewise, successful classical counterinsurgency in the Americas, Africa, and Asia has been closely tied to improvements in governance, integrated administrative systems, and joint interagency action. At the global level, no world government exists with the power to integrate the actions of independent nations to the extremely close degree required by traditional counterinsurgency theory, nor can regional counterinsurgency programs be closely enough aligned to block all insurgent maneuver. This is particularly true when the enemy, as in this case, is not a Maoist-style mass rural movement, but a largely urban-based insurgency, operating in small cells and teams with an extremely low tactical signature in the urban clutter of globalized societies. In today's international system, a unified global approach, even only in those areas directly affected by Al-Qaeda-sponsored jihad, would be intensely problematic. It would demand cooperation far beyond anything yet achieved between diverse states. Robert Kagan has argued that the current crisis of legitimacy affecting U.S. efforts to exercise global leadership in the war on terrorism is a symptom, rather than a cause, of a deepening geostrategic division between Europe and America. While this division persists, under the international system as currently constituted, any nation powerful enough to act as a global counterinsurgency supremo would tend to lack legitimacy. Conversely, any collective or multinational grouping, such as the UN Security Council, that could muster unquestioned legitimacy would tend to lack sufficient power to act effectively against Islamist insurgents or their state sponsors. It would be fatally constrained by the very factors: sovereign equality of states, non-intervention in the internal affairs of states, multilateral consensus, that generated its legitimacy. Thus, the entire concept of counterinsurgency, in its classical form, with a single supremo coordinating actions, is highly problematic when applied at the global level. Similarly, classical counterinsurgency seeks to deny enemy sanctuaries, prevent infiltration into the area where the conflict is occurring, and isolate insurgents from support. A global insurgency has limited vulnerability to many of these measures because of the phenomenon of failed and failing states and ungoverned, undergoverned, or poorly governed areas between states, such as the tribal areas on the Pakistan-Afghan border described above. This allows geographical sanctuary for insurgents, while international flows of information and finances provide cyber sanctuaries, where insurgents can operate. So a globalized insurgency demands a rethink of traditional counterinsurgency. What is required is counterinsurgency redux, not the templated application of 1960s techniques. Both counterterrorism and counterinsurgency provide some answers, but an integrated approach is needed that draws on both disciplines, modifies them for current conditions, and develops new methods applicable to globalized insurgency. The next section applies complexity theory to derive a model of how counterinsurgency redux might look.